architecture of the Netbook in the future is whether it will permit an open space, or whether the forces of property and government will dominate to such an extent that it becomes a completely controlled space, where everyone has a universal identifier, where every time you go on the net, you're somehow marked and traced, and it's capable of being examined. So, I don't know, the Matrix is one whole image. Enemy of the State, have you seen Enemy of the State?
Yeah.
You want to get kids talking about the future of the net, Enemy of the State is a very good place to have a role.
I know that all schools should have an AUP, which is an acceptable use policy. And I know just recently we had an episode with our email account where another student logged into another email account. So we suspended the email's accounts. And we're going to send out another letter to parents. And we sent out an acceptable use policy. I think that's the way you can first start to enforce law in schools. I think what we're doing is we're talking about like the cyber world, and I think we can, in schools, I would like to see us approach on a much smaller scale, but expose the kids to things that are important, that are positive. It's difficult because I think we have a lot of power in schools, and this is the way that students can learn how to design web pages and so forth, but then in learning that, they also can become, I don't know what the word that I'm looking for, but like they can take and put a negative spin on that by abusing the knowledge that they do have. You expose them and say, well, you can actually get into, you know, hacking and, you know, decoding encryptions and downloading this, and well, kids might get into that. And unfortunately, you can make a lot of money doing that. Students can become entrepreneurs in that, especially when we talk about high school. And you see the media display, okay, you can start up a company on a credit card or a couple of $1,000, and you know, it's easy to run your own website. All you have to do is you set up a server and you have your computer and you have people who access your machine. That's basically what the internet is. It's just a bunch of machines that are connected.
Yep.
And what I say that to my students because I want them to realize that, okay, when you access a different website, you are actually accessing that computer. And I think that's powerful. When we took an interactive field trip to France, they were able to, you know, go up and down Eiffel Tower. I think that's positive in the experience. But I would like the experiences to be positive.
Well, let me ask, how many of your students are intermediate? How many have through the school some kind of email? Yeah, see, now email is like the number one use of the internet. That's number one. It's been far more important than any other. And I completely agree with you that if you want to start working at a level of developing norms and practices, email is a great place to start. How you use and how you can be abused with email. Spam and attitudes towards spam by something. As soon as you start becoming an email user, you become sensible to yourself. You know, you start sorting this crap out, and you start to understand how you can send spam out, and how within a school, particularly, it's possible to use and abuse spam. Some of the most interesting conceptual issues of the internet have to do with spam control, private means of spam control. There's something called black hole. I don't know whether you, one of the businesses of the internet is what's called a black hole list, which is a private company which sells a program that institutions can buy that filters spam. The problem with it is that it filters some stuff that isn't spam. So it's quite possible that if you've gotten on all Nixie's black hole list, you send an email, it never gets to where it's going, and you never get a bounce back, it just goes into a black hole. years. Once again, we get this issue about how this internet space is going to govern and who's going to be doing the governance. And, so basically what I'm saying is, yeah, I totally agree with you that if you want to think locally about developing norms from the immediate experience of the kids, that the governance issues around their access within a school and their use of the tools that are provided is a very excellent way to do it. So Bob, how about if I turn it over to you at this point?
Sounds fine. I think I'm going to stand just because of this computer, so then I can at least see everybody. Let me just get a little handout going around here. I might be a couple of shorts, as it turns out, there's a couple extra more people here than I originally thought, so if a couple of people can share, and I'll just be referring to it a couple of times. Now, what I'm going to do basically is I'm going to spend about the next 30 minutes or so, right before our break and then before we move to do our interactive hands-on treasure mine, I'm going to spend about 30 minutes or so just talking about the whole concept of doing research on the internet. I'm going to talk about kind of the pros and cons. I'm going to provide a few strategies on really how you can help both yourself and your kids use the right search tool. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about what's a really hot issue these days is really the whole question of assessing reliability and quality of what's found next on the when you do come to a site. I'll pretty much just kind of be talking and occasionally using this computer, but feel free to, you know, come type in with a question as I'm going along, and also we have a couple of minutes at the end. But before I start, I just want to do kind of a quick mini poll here, and I'm going to ask you if you can put yourself in one of four categories. I'm going to ask just for a show of hands in a second as to whether you're, in terms of how you feel about getting around and finding stuff on the internet, if you feel like you're a complete novice, like you've never done it or really have had no experience, if you feel you're a beginner, you look for stuff but you really don't feel you know how to find anything, or if you feel like you're an intermediate, or you feel like you're totally comfortable about it, don't have any problems finding it. So, and how many people put themselves in the novice category? Okay, so everyone's at least been on the internet. Pretty much that's the norm these days. It wouldn't have been so even just a year or so ago. How many would say they feel more like a beginner? Okay, you've got one or two, okay. How many feel intermediate, say? Most everybody. And anybody for advanced? One. Okay, good, great. Okay, good. Well, that's good. I'll know then that kind of a level of what I'll be talking about today. It'll be for people that are generally, you know, been on the internet, know their way around, but feel that they could know a little bit more. Okay, let me first talk a little bit about the whole concept of how the internet and research connect. You know, why do you use the internet to do research? You know, your first thought might be these days, or a kid's first thought might be, well, why do you use a kettle to boil water? You know, isn't it automatic? I mean, isn't that what it's there for? Well, and it's true that in a lot of ways, going on the internet or doing research, let's say, has become virtually synonymous with going on the internet. But that was really not true just up until just recently, even a couple of years ago, when professional researchers, and these are the people that would, quote, go online, when they went online to do important research, they would go to professional databases, things called like Dialog or LexisNexis, or they'd search a CD-ROM, an academic CD-ROM in a library, and the internet was seen as stuff with trivia and useless junk and stuff you'd steer away from. And, you know, and hard to find stuff. And while those drawbacks still remain on the internet, there's no question there's problems in finding good stuff and evaluating it, it's also become the place to go to do research, whether it's scholarly information, electronic journals, government data and reports, and so much more. Although the internet is tricky to search and there are pitfalls, you know, it really has become the preferred place, even for the professional researchers, the top librarians, that's where they go first, that's where they go. They go to the net. You know, they looked down upon it for a long time, but now everybody has agreed, despite its problems, that's the first place you go. It's not the last place necessarily, but it's the first place that most people go to do research. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about what I see as sort of the pros and cons of this new medium as being the place that we go to do research. Let me just kind of tick off a little list of what I see as the good and the bad of this state of affairs, at least as of today. First of all, the internet has created new sources of information that actually came into being because of the internet. Didn't even exist because of the internet. Things like e-journals, electronic journals. There really was no such thing before the internet. And the online discussion groups. There really was no good equivalent before the internet. So the internet has created new types of sources. And it's also provided a very efficient medium for accessing already existing sources. More efficient, in fact, find sources, important sources that already were out there, things like newspapers and magazines, especially like international newspapers, for example, and electronic versions of existing print journals. So it's made it more efficient, in a sense, to find those standard sources that were already in print that have become digitized or made available on the net. It's also made an enormous amount of information available. It's estimated now there's over 800 million web pages out there. It's allowed access to non-mainstream views. Before the internet, in order to get your word out to a large group of people, you had to have a couple of things to be able to, quote, publish. You had to have access to a printing press, or at least a desktop publisher, and you had to have a means to distribute that, whether it's delivery trucks or satellite. Those are the barriers of entry to become a publisher. The internet has demolished those barriers of entry. So now, in a sense, everybody can be a publisher. It's a double-edged sword, as we'll hopefully get a chance to talk about a little bit. What it has allowed is those who didn't have access to getting their word out, fringe groups, out of the mainstream, people whose voices weren't being heard, now can be heard on the internet. So that's another positive aspect. Also, it's provided access to obscure and arcane information, things that have been just really hard to find, just really obscure questions you can now find answers to. Another good thing about doing research on the internet is it's allowed access to digitized versions of primary source, in other words, library collections, things that have, you know, letters from Thomas Jefferson or what do they call them? The verbal histories, oral histories of migrant workers, treaties, international treaties. Before you have to go to that library, and now a lot of libraries are digitizing these, putting them up on even the Vatican. The Vatican, one of the most famous library of precious materials in the world, is putting some of their material online for researchers. They don't actually have to go to the Vatican. Access to searchable databases and data sets. Again, before the internet, to go and search a database, you usually have to pay a fee to an expensive service and search a database or go to a CD-ROM that you need to have to buy or use the library. Now you can search a lot of those online databases on the internet as they're migrating to the internet. Access to governmental information. An enormous amount of governmental information is going on in the net. Federal, U.S. federal, all kinds of because one of their main missions, of course, in addition to carrying out whatever their purpose is, whether it's housing or commerce or communications, is to disseminate the information to the public as widely and easily as possible. The internet is allowing them to get their information out cheaply, fast, and to as many people as possible. Access to international information, official data from other countries' embassies, consulates, and foreign government, and other countries' newspapers. All of this is available on the internet. So really, you know, we're at a point where the internet, you know, truly is a wealth of great information. On the downside, on the other hand, of course, despite its real and growing benefits to the researcher, the internet still presents certain drawbacks. Now let me tick off a few of what I think are the most significant ones, ones you just need to keep in mind in context as you're going to the internet to do research. One is the other side of the coin of this diversity of types of information. A traditional database would be a substantive collection of all data on the same topic that you would search. It might be a database of business newspaper articles. It might be a database of environmental laws. It might be a database of biographical information on people. The internet, in a sense, being one large database, so different than a database too, is everything all mixed together. You know, a refereed scholarly paper on particle physics, a 14-year-old's essay on summer vacation, newswire feeds from AP and Reuters, misinformation from a Holocaust denial group, commercials, advertisements, all this diversity, in a sense, makes it all the more difficult to pinpoint what you want and to make sure that it's reliable information. Another drawback to the internet is that it's just really hard to search effectively. Again, a traditional database was what's called structured. Every item in that database would be created, massaged in a way to make it easy to search by using certain kinds of tags, things that professional researchers would know how to do effectively. But on the internet, using search engines, they're very imperfect, and they don't still do that great a job. Third drawback to the internet is that there's an emphasis on new information. Because the web didn't really appear till the early 90s, for the most part, what you find on the web is just stuff from the early 90s. Now, that's changing a little bit as libraries and other organizations are digitizing and adding old information. But you have to keep in mind that you're going to have a bias to the new. Another drawback to the internet is a lack of context. When you go to a web page somewhere, you have no, unlike a book, where you can look at the beginning and say, what were the methodologies, what were the assumptions. You're in the middle of a document somewhere, you may not be able to put that in the proper perspective. It's like jumping into the middle of a conversation. Another drawback is a lack of permanence. Web pages are notorious and unstable. They appear, move, disappear. This could be a real problem for people doing serious research, like in academia, where you've got to cite a source so that other people can then come back to it. That web page may be gone. And finally, another big drawback of the internet is the selectivity of coverage. Despite the size of the internet, most of the world's knowledge still remains in print. So even an exhaustive search of the internet, which in fact search engines cannot do, because studies have shown that even most search engines only can index about 1/6 of the web, so you have to use multiple search engines to try and get some overlap. But even if you were able to search over the internet, you know, kids need to know, of course, that does not by any means represent all the world's knowledge. It's just what's on the internet, even though it is a huge amount of information. And in fact, even what's on the web can't be found by all search engines, because there are sites that can put up kind of like no trespass or off-limit signs that block search engines from coming, or sites that use passwords where people have to register or pay a fee. Those can't even be found by search engines. So you need to realize that even if you did a perfect search on the best search engine, you're still not only not getting all the world's knowledge, you're not even getting what's out on the net. Okay, now I want to kind of move to kind of a part two and talk about the different tools on the web for finding what you need. And again, I have to kind of compress a lot into just about 10 minutes here, but this maybe will give you some sense of your choices you have when you go on the net, because not all search engines are the same and not all information finding tools are the same by any means. I'm going to talk about different tools. The first tool I'm going to talk about are really what are called hierarchical indexes rather than a search engine. And the best known example of a hierarchical index is Yahoo. People call it a search engine, but it really isn't. And site like Yahoo, what they do is basically they have real people, indexers, librarians, that look at sites that people submit and they categorize them in categories. And so they'll look at a site and they'll say, okay, I'm going to put it into this category. And Yahoo's not the only one. There's also one called Look Smart, and there's some that are devoted primarily for academic or serious researchers. But the good thing about this is that you basically can be pretty guaranteed that if you go to the right category, it's going to be relevant, because actual people have decided that this website belongs in this category or subcategory or sub-subcategory. It's also going to help you avoid information overload, because they are selective, they're going to just choose with, they're not going to be any spam or junk or porn sites, as far as I know, in these, but they're going to be relevant to the category, so maybe there'll be a porn category. Yeah?
I have a question. What do you refer to when we say spam?
Spam actually relates more to like sending someone an email that they don't want. It could be an advertisement or a porn site. On the web, I'm talking more about a page that maybe you just don't want to go to. Maybe it's a porn site, or maybe it's something that's just, you know, someone's trying to thrust at you. Some people that create porn sites, for example, manipulate their pages to try and get high rankings on search engines. So if you go to a regular search engine, like we'll talk about in a minute, like AltaVista, for example, you might get, even if you search on an innocuous word, you may end up getting all these porn sites, for example, because the search engine is blind. It's a robot that just finds sites by using a mathematical formula. The advantage of going to an index like Yahoo is that people, librarians and indexers, avoid they won't put in something, they can't be spam because they look at each item. So on the downside of a hierarchical index is that they're very selective, of course, because they can't cover everything. You're going to have a much smaller amount of information or number of websites than you would if you went to a regular search engine, though these days that may not be such a bad thing. By the way, for kids, there's a very nice, this is going to be one of our search, one of our treasure hunt things, but yeah. This is a Yahoo site for kids called yahooligans.com. Okay, and it's a nice way to kind of, and they pick out some nice sites. And again, you know, you can go, you know, around the world, and you click on countries, you know, then you can go to Algeria, and then, you know, it's again, it's a sub-index, and you can say, okay, well, let's, you know, look at the flag of Algeria, or, you know, whatever it is, but they find websites that they feel is appropriate for the different categories. Okay, then, in addition to these hierarchical indexes, they're just the plain old search engines that people generally know about. And you know, one that I often use, for example, is AlphaVista.com. And search engines are different in that they don't have people look at all sorts of sites, but if you put in a word, okay, it found a mere 195,000 pages. We can go through all those in a few minutes. And what they do, what search engines do is look at keywords that are in the site and match them up with your keywords. And they have their, each search engine has its own mathematical formula, its own algorithm for just determining what should be a top ranked site. They look at things like how often your keyword was found in the site, whether it was near the title, how rare the word is, and so forth. And search engines will search more of the web than like an index like Yahoo, for example, and are kind of a standard way to do a search. And I don't think I have time to talk about it today, but in one of the handouts, I have a few search strategies and search techniques, because the big problem these days is getting overwhelmed with too many. It's not finding anything, it's having too many sites. Then there's also what I like to call alternative search engines, which work a little differently but can be helpful. For example, one that I like is called, there's a few that I like, one called northernlight.com. What's nice about this one is if you do a search, it will organize your results into these different folders. And those folders have subfolders in them too. And it's not a perfect technology, but it helps you organize your results. And so, you know, if you click on, well, let's see what it says for internet, under Algeria, and then under internet, okay, internet service providers. So maybe those would be websites of internet service providers in Algeria, let's say. Another alternative website search engine that I like very much, in fact, it's become my search engine of choice, which used to be AltaVista, but it's one called Google. Yeah. Anybody ever use Google?
Yeah.
Okay. Google has a completely different method of ranking its, making its rankings. What it does is, very interestingly, it, of course, it matches your keywords, which it needs to do first to make sure it's found relevant sites. But then it also looks at the site, looks at sites and sees how many other sites have linked to it and how many sites have linked to those sites, and whoever has the most linked sites gets ranked at the top. It's kind of a popularity contest. And the reasoning behind this and why it's supposed to work and why it actually does work most of the time is sort of just the same way as if you drive by a diner and one has a lot of trucks parked in front of it and the other's got nobody, you might pick the one with a lot of trucks because you assume, you know, that the food is good there. So again, it's so this site here, apparently, that it ranked top, has more links to it than any other sites. This is the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Texas, has more links to it from other sites than any other. So I like Google a lot. One last alternative search engine I might mention that's a kind of fun one, especially for kids. AskJeeves.com. Anybody use this one?
Nope.
Okay. This one you can actually ask a question in plain English, because it stores a database of all questions that's been asked, and then behind the scenes tries to find a site. So if I want to say, you know, just where can I find information on Algeria, and then I say ask, Ask Jeeves will then say, let's see, it actually was able to figure it out. Okay, here are its sites. What it does, this part kind of ignores, a little confusing, they search other search engines. But what it does is, it doesn't look like it actually may not know your answer. See, it doesn't always work either. Sometimes it does, sometimes it all depends on whether they've already, oh, you know what? It might have been because I had a typo there. Let's see if I got rid of that, if that helps. Okay, yeah, see, and it's guessing. These are popular things that people guess. Where can I find a map of the country Algeria? Where can I find a historical economic? So it suggests possible things that you may then want to click on. So I don't use this one too much myself, but it's, again, it's sort of a fun one. It's a little different. It doesn't always work, but when it does, it's interesting. Okay, finally there's...
I like the questions they have there at the beginning. Where can I find good paper lines?
Oh, yeah, they have some creative ones. And finally, a final category of search tools I'll mention here are something called meta search engines. One that I like is called dogpile.com. And a great name, but, you know, but what they do is search other search engines, so you can search more of the web. So if I, again, if I put in Algeria and say fetch, and this is really good for very obscure, very arcane, rare questions where you really think it's going to be hard to find anything. It's not good for normal searches, because they have to reduce your search down to the lowest common denominator that all search engines can understand. But it's good for just single word or phrases. So for example, it said, okay, LookSmart found 125 documents. And if you go down, it'll tell you, you know, the search engine GoToCom found 10 documents. So it can, again, really good for obscure kinds of information. I'm going to go to something here to get ready for my... Now, any questions on the search engines? I know I'm going kind of fast to get a lot in. Yeah.
I have a quick question. How do you find out about search? How did you come across all these different things? Is there a resource that you can use?
Well, there are some... There's a lot on the internet about search engines. There's a really good site. It's a little bit advanced. It's more for, like, not experts in the field, but... If you went around there a couple times, you get the hang of it. It's called searchenginewatch.com, all one word. That's probably my favorite site, and it really has a lot of good features and comparisons and tables comparing search engines. Searchenginewatch.com, another very good one is a colleague of mine called Greg Notess. It's Notess.com. He's a professor at Montana State University. Those are two probably my favorite sources for keeping up with search engines. And there are books, you know, there's there's a great dummies guide written by a colleague of mine who we're just going to hear on the radio in a second here, Riva Bash, who's an expert in the field, so a dummies guide to online research. And it's a stupid name, dummies, but it's a very good book. And that kind of leads me into this last portion, which I'm going to talk about, is how to evaluate the quality of information that you find. And that colleague I was just mentioning, her name's Riva Bash. She was just interviewed this past Friday. She's one of the people interviewed on this issue. And I'd like to play it. It's 4 minutes long. And if I can find it.
Is it on search engines?
Oh, it should just say like internet is a short one.
Oh,
it's up. I missed it.
Internet.
Is it up or down?
Up.
Oh, there it is. Okay, great. And this kind of relates to the checklist and the handout too. But let me see if we can, how we can do this.
And what site is this on?
This is on NPR. She was in National Public Radio.
On NPR site.
NPR.org.
Okay.
And let's see how this turns out. Let's see if we can hear. Is it?
In a report on the program last month, NPR's David Kessler used the quotation Prediction is critical, especially about the future. The attribution work physicist feels bored. A listener set a challenge. Mr. Kestenbaum, he wrote, I used this quote in 1750 to quote Sam Goodwin and Mark Twain. Do you have a citation for your attribution? Mr. Kestenbaum has this response and a cautionary tale about facts on the internet.
The quote is not to Mark Twain. So I did what I think of any quote. I went to a search engine on the web and typed in the exact words in quotation. The search engine came back with a couple dozen websites, showing pages listing favorite aphorisms, transcripts, speeches, online articles, and a couple of them did cite Niels Bohr. Others credited Yogi Berra, Dan Quayle, Mark Twain, Werner Heisenberg, and Master of Malaprop, Samuel Goldwyn.
So that's where it came.
Justin Kaplan had his Bartlett's quotations.
There's an analogy between people using the internet to track down quotations and the origins of Bartlett's familiar quotations. Bartlett himself was the equivalent of a database. People figured that he knew things, and eventually this turned into a book, and it got bigger and bigger and older and older, and I must say, better and better.
That doesn't mean the internet is getting better. Kaplan says he does consult a couple trusted websites for information about lines from movies or popular songs. But in general, he says, information you find on the web at large is probably no more accurate than what you would get consulting a friend on the phone.
If you're doing a quotation book like Bartlett's, you still have to go back and do the dog work of establishing who said it, when, and what the true text is.
Kaplan is a gatekeeper. He's the reason people trust the book. The internet, on the other hand, doesn't have a gatekeeper. And Reba Bash, author of Secrets of the Super Net Searchers, says increasingly people are consulting the internet at large to find simple facts. When was the Battle of the Bulge? Is there really a J in Reykjavik? Often, some website has the right answer, but a single error can propagate wildly on the net. Bash cites the example of the text of a graduation speech by Kurt Vonnegut that imparted these words of wisdom, wear sunscreen.
As it turns out, it was a column by Mary Spinach, who's a columnist for the Chicago Tribune, I believe. But it went around the world, largely on the strength of Kurt Vonnegut's name. And of course, when word got back to Vonnegut, it turned out he doesn't even have an email address. He hates the internet.
Internet users understand that websites can be biased. But Bash says people often underestimate the possibility that common facts can be wrong.
I think it goes back to the early days of computers where somehow the computer was, the computer, capital R, was invested with mystical powers. You know, it could compute faster than the human mind could, so it somehow acquired this reputation of reliability.
Some high schools are teaching students to look at web pages critically, she says. But the printed word, whether on a screen or a piece of paper, still retains the appearance of authority, all of which raises concerns about the future. If many facts on the web are reliable, what happens to the few that appear everywhere but aren't?
It does call the definition of reality into question. You know, if enough people arrive at a consensus on a fact, does the nature of reality change?
So did Yogi Berra say prediction is difficult, especially about the future? Maybe he was quoting Niels Bohr. A search of newspaper clippings shows that reputable sources like the Washington Post have credited Niels Bohr with the line. If anyone knows, it should be Abraham Pice, who wrote an extensive biography of Bohr. I asked him, did Niels Bohr ever say that?
I cannot say, it could well be, but I am not sure. I like Yogi Berra better, to tell you the truth. He was brilliant. More brilliant in quotes than Niels Bohr. But if Bohr could have said it, we have to be more positive, but I'm also an honest man, you know.
I'm sticking with Bohr. As Napoleon once said, what is history but a fable agreed upon? That's what it says on the web. David Kestenbaum, NPR News, Washington.
Excellent. So, I mean, it's kind of a good little summary of the pro and con of evaluating what you find on the net. I mean, just to wrap up in a minute or two, while we get ready for our next stage. I mean, I've had some great experience For example, a couple of years ago, my aunt in San Diego came down with this terrible eye disease, the abbreviation being AION. Her doctor said there's nothing that can be done about it. She knew I did a lot of research on the internet. Can you find me anything on this? The doctor said there's nothing to be done. I did a bunch of searches, and I found a press release on a university site where one of its doctors had just published a paper where he just finished testing a drug that found a statistically significant difference in the recovery of people using this drug to treat this disease. It was also a drug that was used to treat lazy eye. I don't remember what the drug was. And so I printed this out, I mailed it to my aunt, and she brought it into her doctor and said, you know, what do you think about this? And the doctor, well, let me see. He checked some of his, I haven't heard about this, he checked some of his journals, and in fact, there was a brief mention of this study in the most recent journal that he hadn't really gotten to yet. And he did a little bit more research on it, the doctor, and eventually prescribed that drug, and my aunt did eventually, I don't know if it was because of this drug or not, but she eventually did get over this eye problem, largely. And in this case, what the internet did was provide a conduit quicker to reputable information. There's a little bit of a twist here, but the fact was, this was a press release of a university site that was just, you know, and this is a whole other issue about how it's changing the release of scholarly and scientific information much more quickly in terms of peer review takes months and months. But you know, on the other hand, that quote that they talked about, that prediction is difficult, especially about the future, I used that in a paper once, and I attributed it to Yogi Berra, because I had heard that, or found that on the web, so I was also fooled on the web as well, apparently, or maybe. So it's really a double-edged sword. You know, another issue I had was my cat had a seizure a couple of years ago, and I went on the web to find anything I could about it, and I found this great site. It was number one in the search engine. It had all sorts of detailed information on what to do if your cat has a seizure, and it turned out, with references and citations and personal anecdotes, and it was written by not a veterinarian, but a computer science student at a school, at a university, whose cat had a seizure, and that spurred him into doing all this research and sharing this with other people. So my question was then, you know, well, how do I evaluate this? This is apparently someone with a genuine concern who's done real research and knowledge, but he's not an expert. So it's these kinds of, and a lot of this anecdotal information, which is very interesting, I think, because the internet is allowing people to share back and forth, just like you would in the office or somewhere else, and the ability to search this kind of informal anecdotal information has never been available before, so you almost need a new way of how to evaluate that, because they don't go through the traditional peer review process. There's no filters like in the magazines and news, or editors and fact checkers and proofers. And, you know, they may not always do the right job. There may be problems, and there are problems, but you know it's gone through some level of scrutiny. There's no level of scrutiny on the internet, but on the other hand, it's opened up all this advice and opinion. People from health groups I know in my family have benefited. So, you know, what do you do? And I think ultimately it comes down to trust. You know, who do you trust? And why do you trust so-and-so in your real life and not someone else? So, you know, trust is hard to quantify. I've come up with a little checklist in the handout that I think is you know, one way you can sort of evaluate websites by seeing, you know, these are credibility indicators that I put together. And it's a little bit of an artificial exercise, but it can at least help you think a little bit about, you know, why you would trust one website versus another. But I think ultimately it does come down to your gut and trust, and that's a whole new experience on the web. So I think I'm out of time on this portion. Any questions about anything I just went over before we talked just a few minutes about the treasure hunt after the break? Okay. Okay, we're going to take, I guess, about a 5 or 10 minute break. We can just stretch whatever. And then we're going to go to another room. Do you happen to know the room we'll be going to at 12? Where the laptops are?
I was told that, I guess, this group right here won't be able to go to the lab because I guess the people that are using it right now, they won't be finished using it at the time that you all were going to need
it. Did they know about when they'd be done, or just someone could find out?
I can ask Thaddeus. Thaddeus was one that told me.
Okay.
So I'll find out right
now. When it's free.
Check it out. We're not going to take no for an answer.
It's cool.
You want to do this trick. That's
cool.
When it becomes free, what we're going to do is kind of a two-part exercise. This is just a little... We were trying to think of ways it might be fun to teach kids to search the internet, and we came up with kind of a scavenger hunt for the first 15 minutes, and sort of a treasure hunt for the other 15 minutes. And it's something you can just sort of try out yourself as if you were the students and think about whether this is a nice way to get kids comfortable with searching for information on the net. And the scavenger hunt will be where once we get to pair up on the computers, like two or three a person, but we're gonna go to that Yahooligan site, and I'm gonna give, there can be 10 items you have to find that I've kind of come up with. And it'll be like, find a picture of a boat or something like that. Or it's more specific than that. And you'll see it written down. And when you find item number one, you'll have, everyone will have item one, you can raise your hand and call out for item two. And then when you find item two, raise your hand and say three. We'll see, it's sort of like a fun contest if anyone can get to 10 in the 15 minutes. And again, this is something you might want to modify or experiment and think about whether this is a good approach for kids. And the second part is a treasure hunt where we'll be using the Google search engine. There'll be a handout for that where you'll try and find some things that we've located by using the Google search engine by putting in keywords. So, and then that'll wrap up our workshop when that's over.
That is it. He'll have to find out.
Okay. Well, in the meantime, any other questions or some other things to talk about in the meantime as well, so yeah.
I just wanted to make you know, you need a good search engine for our teachers that have good references.
Just for teachers. I'm sure there are out there. Actually, there are some, and this might be a little more for university rather than like junior high or high school, but I do have a couple that I want to mention. I'll give you the exact URL. These are designed for academics, and they're hierarchical index, but they're focused on academic issues. One is called Alpha Search, and it's got a kind of a funny address. It's Calvin, calvin.edu/library/AS. Another good one for academic-oriented search engine or actually an index is called BUBL. It's one I like a lot. This comes from England. It's www.bubl.ac.uk/link, L-I-N-K. And then a third one I'll mention is called InfoMine. And the address there is, there's no W, so it's InfoMine. .ucr.edu. Sure. Yeah.
There's also one called classroomconnect.com, and that's good for looking up like curriculums for K-12. And also, if you just go to like a general, just any one of the search engines like Alta Vista, InfoSeek, and if you just type in like lesson plan. Or in type, lesson plans for fifth grade or lesson plans for history, you'll come up with a really good list, and you kind of just play around with it. You'll find a lot of interesting.
One of the best educational websites is I don't know, but it's Kathy Sharma. Her website is it's a teacher, I believe, in Maine, and she would get a lot of like. Websites, and what she did is she compiled and breaks it down according to subject, and I think the Discovery Channel now supports the website. I don't know the website, but if you do a search on her name, I'm pretty sure you
can. How do you spell her name?
Kathy.
Educlace.com is another one.
Sorry,
please
speak up.
Educlace, lac.com.
Now, if you would go to the search engine watch.com, could you be able to find search other search engine?
Yeah, they list. Yeah, they list about. They keep track of about 12 or 15 of the major search engines. What he is interested in, his site is, a lot of it is for people that want to get their sites highly ranked, which is a whole other issue with searching the web. But at the same time, it's also useful for people that just want to know how search engines differ. My own book actually has a big section on how to choose and find search engines, and that's, if you're interested, it's called Find It Fast. It's published by HarperCollins. But the hard part, though, with books is that it's very hard to keep them up to date. You know, things change so quickly. So, you know, they're not always your best resource for finding information. They're good for principles, but not, you know, the latest stuff on the net. One thing I just want to ask the group, too, if anyone has it, you know, what's like your biggest frustration when you do a search in a search engine? What causes you the most problems?
Too many responses.
Too many.
Not narrow enough.
Right. That seems like the big problem these days. Information overload is there are strategies, there are techniques you can use, and a lot of it, all it means, I mean, all it matters is, it could be as simple as reading the help pages of the search engine you choose, because they tell you really how to narrow the searches. And the one I think is best, though, for avoiding information overload is the Google site. I very rarely get too many. The other thing you need to keep in mind is that even though you may get 800,000 hits back, because they're ranked by relevancy, you only usually need to read the first few screens worth. You don't need to feel somehow obligated that because it says it returned this many million, that you have to feel overwhelmed. That's a natural reaction, but you only have to read the first 10, 20, or 30, maybe. Also, it's worth thinking a little bit about learning a little bit of what's called Boolean searching. It's very basic. Most sites allow it. And what it does is allow you to restrict your search by using connecting words like and near, for example. AltaVista is the only one that allows the word near, which is technically not a Boolean operator. It's technically just and, not, and or. But you go to AltaVista Advanced, and you can put in something like children near diabetes if you want to find, and it will only return hits where those words are within 20 words of each other. It won't just be like the word children is at the beginning of a document and diabetes is at the end of the document, and it won't be relevant, and the words don't have to do with each other. So you can use these and operators, these near operators, to really help be more precise in your searching. So some of it is really just taking the time to read the search tips, and they do a pretty good job, whether it's AltaVista or Google, or if you have another favorite, and they will tell you, you know what to do in those cases. It's a problem, no question. Part of it's psychological, you know, this feeling that there's just too much. You know, why don't we feel that when we walk into a library? You know, there's a million books. Why don't we feel overwhelmed? You know, there's reasons for that. How it's categorized, how we're familiar with it. The fact that we know it's all substantive and useful, it's not aggressive. It's sitting there waiting for us. This stuff is like your emails. You're like warding it off. It's almost like a hostile invasion of information. So there's a psychological element, I think, too, to this feeling of perception of information overload. Do we have a demo here?
I'm trying to get the answer, but I can't. It won't connect to the server. I'm not sure why. So.
Bob, when you talked about academic searches, alpha search, was that hierarchical?
Yes.
And what about the BULB?
They all were. Those three were all the hierarchical index.
Okay.
And they're all done by indexers and librarians, and those are all, the Yahoo and the LookSmart is for a popular audience. Those three are really for university, but really, in a sense, any educator, mm-hmm. you know, would benefit from it in terms of their categories and so forth. One thing I didn't get to talk about also, since we have a few extra minutes, and we probably should take our break, is on the page one in your handout, in terms of the strategies for searching the internet. There is an art, also, to conducting a good search. This is something that I think is real important for kids to know. Most people do sit down and just type a couple of words into their search engine. And actually, search engines these days don't do a bad job in deciphering it. But you can, another way to avoid information overload is just knowing the whole art and process of creating a good search statement. And it's funny because for years, this is something that librarians were taught in school. They got their MLS. This is a skill that people had to go to school to learn how to do, and now it's assumed, because we all have this internet, that we should all be able to have this skill that we were never taught on how to do effective research and how to come up with effective search statements. And it is something that isn't automatic. So a lot of it has to do with, you know, knowing how to identify the keywords in your search, really zeroing. The first approach is to know what it is exactly you're researching, because if you're vague, if your student's vague, you're not going to get anywhere. So you have to really think through it, almost conduct an interview with yourself. You know, why do I need this information? What am I going to do with it? And as you go through that process, you can pull out key words. And the other key, though, is then thinking of synonyms for those words. Because remember, a search engine is literal. It can only match those words that you plug in. So if you put in greenhouse gases, you may also want to put in global warming or climate change. So you need to think of greater and brainstorm. This might be a good exercise for kids to do too. You know, how, you know, just a synonym teaching skill. How else can we say this? And that's important for doing good searches. Also, you want to be able to.
And Bob, isn't that part of the strategy with the treasure hunt?
Yes.
You actually get a group dynamic going as to what the most effective search technique is and share technique.
Right, because there are different ways to try things, and then, you know, as you actually go on the web, you'll see that some things work and some don't. And for example, one thing that's very important to do is use phrases whenever you can. Two or three words, most search engines, if you put them in quotation marks, it's much better to search for example, if you're doing research on Jewish genealogy, to search for, quote, Jewish genealogy than just the two words by themselves, or just the word genealogy. Or if you're searching for attention deficit disorder, put those words in quotation marks, and most search engines will look for those three words in a row as a phrase. You don't want to just define the document as the word attention somewhere, deficit somewhere else, and disorder somewhere else. You want that phrase. So that's another way to really do precision relevant research, is to use phrases wherever possible. And here is just kind of an example of this. A truncation is also something that's good to know about. And truncation is when you want to search for all variations of a root word. So, and most search engines allow you to do this by putting an asterisk at the end of the root word. For example, in this example I'm doing below on the search related to the death penalty, you can see I used truncation under number 4 after the word C-O-U-N-T-R, so that'll pick up both country and countries. Execute, with an asterisk, will pick up execute, executing, executes, executed, and so forth. And nation, include nations and national. So these are probably a few of the most important general search strategies to use when going out on the web. Truncation, phrase searching, and coming up with good synonyms of your keywords. And also, just in terms of coming up with good keywords, try to find nouns are the best, and the more unusual the noun is, the better. Search engines sort of like to chomp on these nouns better than they do, you know, verbs or adjectives. Anything else? And I guess maybe we should take a break. Or...
Bob, thank you very much. I think it's going to be highly
educated. Thanks. So I guess we at 12:15 we should. Find out if we're going to get to our room. Maybe we'll reconvene in here if we don't have any other place to go.
Excuse me, were you online? I took a group photo.
That's fine.
As long as you don't have to make a prayer prayer.
Everybody over there, I think of that, but. Come on around to this side. We'll have a nice light from the window. Nice smile.
We're going to have to make it tighter.
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 Okay. Now. Want to come in, guys?
Come on, Pat, get in here.
And if we could make it a little bit tighter from the left and right end, move in, or get in front, or whatever you have to do. All right, do that way. Okay. Is anybody smiling, blinking, or anything? I'm gonna take another one. Here you go.
No flash.
No flash? Well, wait 1 second. Thank you.
Wiz, the joint is still recording. The red light seems to be on.